Hello, everyone. Meet Brian Leaf. Brian is a yogi, and he's also a parent. And sometimes the combination between our spiritual journey and our parenting journey is, I would say, two things. It can be very confusing and very enlightening. Would you agree with that, Brian? Welcome to the show, Paradigm Shifters.
Hi, thanks for having me. I suppose I would agree with that. Confusing and enlightening.
I love, there's a lot of things in your book that are really actually quite hilarious, but also you have a lot of information, and your book is called The Misadventures of the Parenting Yogi. How long were you a yogi?
How long, say again?
How long were you a yogi?
Oh, well, let's see, I first got into yoga when I went off to college in 1989. I was 17 years old.
Oh, wow. So you've really been at it a while, huh?
I have. And, you know, when I first got into it, I got really into it and did a lot of yoga. And then about 8 years ago, my son was born. And since then, I've done less yoga, but at least on the mat. But, you know, still practicing.
Yeah, but what's really interesting, doesn't yoga mean kind of the teaching of, the learning of? Yoga itself doesn't necessarily, usually implies exercise for a lot of us, but doesn't it actually mean getting control of your mind and the essence of your being, that sort of thing?
Exactly. It's true. And you know, we've sort of made an implicit agreement, I think, in the U.S. that when we say yoga, we mean the aerobics class that we all go to, you know. But no, you're
outfit,
right.
You know.
What's that?
With a great outfit.
You know, but you're right, actually. Yoga comes from the root yuj, which means to join or to unite, to yoke, really. And so it means to basically to get in touch with our deeper self, I would say. There's a lot of different ways to define it in the Yoga Sutras and whatnot. But so you're right. I mean, the physical postures are just, you know, one small part, technically, of really what you're trying to accomplish. They're really just a means. You know, the physical postures are there to open up the channels and open up the energy channels and to get you ready to be able to sit in meditation and get clear and connect to your deeper self, to the God within you.
I love that. And so when I was reading your book, which is hilarious, I got to tell people, when you're talking about things that we want to get into in this discussion, like circumcision and breastfeeding and healing techniques and poopy diapers and not getting enough sleep, I'm laughing because I'm a mom too. I'm a grandmom now. But also all the way through it, I get the sense of your doing that fusion of really in the middle of it all, trying to keep yourself at least moving toward a state of consciousness, making that root of parenting a real yoga, right?
Yeah. I would say that that, you know, even though I've had less time to do the physical postures over the last bunch of years, it really, you know, parenting is such an opportunity to, I believe personally, you know, there's so many approaches to parenting, and there's, you know, there's helicopter parenting and free-range parenting and simplicity parenting and unconditional parenting, you know, overprotective parenting. There's all kinds of tiger mom parenting. And I really believe that the best parenting for each of us, and this is, and the best everything, actually, the best worker we can be, the best, you know, person, the best partner, the best parent, I think comes from tuning in and checking in and being conscious of and connecting to our heart and our intuition and our instinct and our gut. And acting from that place. I mean, I really believe that that's where we're going to find, as a human being, that's where we're going to find the most truth and clarity and meaning and abundance even. And so, you know, I think that that's where my yoga has served me the most is hard. Parenting is just so darn hard. It's so taxing, especially the way, I think, not to rant against our culture, but the way things are set up right now, you know, kind of living isolated in suburbia and these individual families in these houses, I think it makes it really, really hard. Kids expect a lot from parents, and parents have a lot they need to do.
And that we don't even have, most of us don't have that community consciousness of extended families that used to be normal, right?
That's my guess. I mean, that's what I've been really thinking and writing a lot about lately is I think that that's what we're missing. I mean, I think that, you know, it's interesting. I think there's a lot of things now that sort of conscious living folks do that have a name that 100 years ago would have just been natural, would have just been organic. You know, like eating organically. Now, you know, you have to pay extra and go to Whole Foods. I mean, 100 years ago, my grandma or her mom, they certainly ate organically. They, you know, that's all there was.
They didn't think of an option, did they?
No, or eating locally or eating from the seasons or, you know, now you'd have to be a really conscious living person to go to the butcher for your meat and the, you know, dairy farm for your milk. But that's what they did organically. I mean, literally, you know, one set of my grandparents owned a mill, and they milled, you know, wheat, and they would trade with the butcher and with the dairy farmers. And so they ate organically, they ate locally, they ate with the seasons. And similarly, I think kids, years and years ago, I have this fantasy that the kids were probably kind of running around in a gaggle of kids, occupying themselves and exploring the world and having experiences. And now, you know, isolated in suburbia, there's not that gaggle of kids. And I think the kids, you know, call to their parents a lot more for attention.
I think there's something else, too. I think so much is marketed, like the kids should have this and they should have that. And I think we've lost touch with being able to, like, explore in the moment and make something out of wherever you are. And, you know, that kind of thing that people used to do, kids used to do, running around climbing trees, you know.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I mean, I think Kim John Payne in the book Simplicity Parenting talks a lot about that. And the Waldorf schools are big on that. That's one of the reasons I really love the Waldorf school system. And exactly that, you know, Kim John Payne talks about in his book Simplicity Parenting, talks about how simplicity breeds this kind of deep creativity and fortitude that will actually serve children well in the workplace and in life and in partnerships. And it's really true. I mean, you know, he talks about the difference between a toy that does only one thing. Like, I never really, when I was a kid, I'd see the commercials of people pushing around this toy, and then I'd get it, and I could never figure out how to use it, like, or what to do with it. Because let's say you have a toy that does one thing. You press a button, and I don't know, like an arm shoots out, and it makes a noise or something. Mm-hmm. And then it's, but what do you do beyond that, you know? And so he talks about the difference between a toy like that and then, you know, just a completely open-ended toy. I don't know, a set of
like plasticine, as we used to have in the olden days, or blocks.
What is it?
Plasticine, to call it. Yeah,
exactly. And you could do anything with it. You could create a whole world, you know, with your imagination. And even
I know I'm a lot older than you, but we used to play with cardboard boxes and pieces of paper and, you know, construction stuff. That's what we did.
You know, there's a great book my kids have, actually. It's called This Is Not a Box. It's really great, a very creative book. It's like a children's, you know, picture book. And this kid has a box, and he does all these different things with it. Like, he turns into a, you know, a race car and an airplane and a rocket ship. And he keeps saying, this is not a box. It's great.
I love that. And but anyway, so have you been able to, like, so what kind of toys do you give your kids?
Well, so, I mean, you know, they have too many toys. They have a million toys. We tried to, in the book I talk about that we tried to do Kim John Payne's approach of sorting. He has this plan where you sort out the toys, and you really remove like 90% of the sort of clutter from your house. And he gives these really compelling studies and anecdotes about how removing the clutter just really relaxes kids, because when there's so much stuff to choose from, they don't know what to do. And that's a pretty common sentiment. I've heard that many times. I had a yoga teacher once who went to India for a long time and lived very simply out there, maybe in a village. And then she came back to the States, or maybe she went to a big city in India, I don't remember. And she went to a supermarket to buy like cereal or toilet paper or something. And she said she literally was like stuck in front of the toilet paper aisle because there were like 30 kinds to choose from. You know, there's like, you know, extra soft with aloe, I don't know, harder kinds, recycled kinds. And she just literally didn't know what to do.
Can see that. I was buying milk recently, which I don't normally drink, and there was such a choice of kinds of milk.
You know, it's true. I guess we rely upon knowing already in that situation, because it's true. If I go to the store to buy something I've never purchased before, it's a little overwhelming. Now, normally you just go and you buy your favorite brand or the one on sale, but if suddenly you have no guidance on that in that way. So, you know, so apparently Kim John Payne says that kids are the same way. When they have this, you know, clutter and clutter and clutter of toys, it's hard to know what to do. So we did, you know, we've always been on that track a little bit. I mean, we try to mostly have toys that don't make too many sounds and don't move on their own, you know, toys that you have to move yourself. And, you know, toys from natural materials if possible. But, you know, like any family in the United States, or, you know, in this area, in the West, we've lots of toys, and many of them are plastic, and some of them speak, and some of them walk around in the middle of the night, and you don't expect. But we do try to keep it pretty simple with natural materials.
I think it's really interesting, too. I went through university to be a school teacher, and one of the things they talked about in raising children was that they should have time to be bored, because it's in the boredom that they come up with a lot of, like, creative things or inventions and so on. Have you noticed that? And a lot of times we don't let the kids be bored anymore. We've loaded them with things to do all the time.
Yeah, no, that's it. Again, that's in that simplicity parenting, which is just one chapter of the book, but it goes to what we're talking about here again. Absolutely, he talks about that, and I think it's true. I think, you know, the reason, I wrote my book to share these things that I felt so grateful to have learned from people in the town I live in and from our midwife and from books I read and studies I've read. And I think people do need to hear that, and they do need to be reminded of that, because it's true. I think that we kind of have a sense right now that being bored isn't so great. I mean, we're like never bored. We might never be satisfied either, but we're never bored because, you know, we have our phones and everybody's so active all the time. And it's true. They say that it's very important. Studies show that it's important to let kids have that experience of being bored, because from that place is where, you know, the phoenix rises up. It's where the real stroke of creativity can hit.
Yeah, and isn't that kind of the yoga of being a kid in a way?
Yeah, and I think it's true for us too. Like, my best work as a writer, you know, doesn't come from my super busy active days. It comes from some time when I have spaciousness to allow the muse to speak, you know, to allow the juices to percolate. Sometimes it's when I'm meditating or walking in the woods. I'm sure any writer has that experience, any creative person, any inventor, you know, probably has that. So I think you're right.
I think it's fascinating. You also gave some very interesting, these are more grounded, I suppose, but you gave some very interesting points about, for example, breastfeeding and tools that you learned from the doula about infections in breastfeeding and cabbage leaves. There's some really fascinating, like, little natural solutions to some difficult problems.
Yeah, you know, the world is a really magical place. It's really neat. I mean, there's more than just the sort of superficial things that we see all the time. So yeah, one of these is for the doctrine of signatures. Have you ever heard of that?
No. I read about it in your book, but I had never heard.
So the doctrine of signatures is this idea that, first of all, ask yourself the question, and this is for listeners too, you know, ask yourself the question, how did native peoples over thousands of years know what to eat and what not to eat? You know, what would kill them and what was safe? I mean, you know, how did they know? I mean, we just go to the store and Whole Foods tells us, but how did they know, you know? And how did they originally know? And how did people know that, I don't know, the certain cohosh or certain root or walnut or whatever would be good for this or good for that? And there's, you know, there's different ideas that people spoke to plants and they channeled them and they meditated with them. But there's also this idea that plants give us information about what they serve. And it's, you know, it's hard not to talk about it without sounding a little woo, you know, woo-woo. But it's amazing. I like woo-woo myself. So, you know, walnuts have been shown to be really good for the brain. And I mean, really, when you open a walnut, it looks just like the brain. It's like amazing.
Yeah.
And cabbage leaves are really good. So, I mean, I've seen this personally. There's no doubt. When my wife would start to have a blockage, like the beginnings of I can't remember what it's called, but beginnings of like mastitis or a blockage in the milk ducts, you know, as soon as she could see that it was getting a little bit red and swollen, or she would send me out to the store to get cabbage, and I would come home with this cabbage, and then she'd take a couple of leaves off and cup it right over the breast. Right on the affected area.
Wow, without even mashing it up or grinding it up or anything.
No, and you can do that, but actually with cabbage you don't have to. And I mean, that's amazing, because really think about it. Like, a cabbage leaf really does look like a breast. I mean, there's even like the veins and the bump, like the nipple bump.
That's true, isn't it? Yeah, I never thought of that. That's really wonderful. And I always think cabbages are like roses if you look at them a certain way as well.
That's true. Yeah, in the different layers. And one more, the carrot. Of course, everybody knows that carrots are good for your eyes. Mm-hmm. You know, that's we've known that a long time. But really, if you slice a carrot, if you do a cross section of a carrot, it really does look like a human eye.
Isn't that amazing?
Even with the, you know, like the veins going through the white part of the eye, you even see that from the pupil. It's amazing.
And somebody was telling me that on NPR they were talking about the chrysalis, and apparently a caterpillar, if it's sliced open, poor thing, but in any case, has the total mapping of the wings. You can see the wings absolutely imprinted in his inner, you know, because it becomes, so it's just the same idea of what you're talking about. Signature. That's really interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, it's kind of amazing. I mean, it's so, it's really just cool. I like opening myself up to these cool things, you know?
Yeah. And I suppose having a baby is one of the greatest accesses to nature and the power of nature, eh?
It's really, that's a good point. I mean, think about, of course, just the miracle of it. I mean, especially when the baby's so tiny, you know, you've got this tiny, tiny little, like, you know, mouse-sized baby who's you know, living in the womb and has little fingers and fingernails. It's just amazing.
Yeah. Now, you also talked about women. It's better for women to have babies than men. And you're actually a very funny writer. I'm just telling listeners, this is a book that will teach you and you'll enjoy learning, but it's hilarious, too. There's a lot of funny parts. But even your comments about women should have babies and not men, do you want to talk about that a little bit?
I can't remember that. What did I say?
Oh, you were very funny. You were saying something like, there's nothing to fix here. There's, a woman's got the kind of...
Oh, yeah, right. Just in the sense of having... Oh, go ahead.
Oh, you go. I just said I was roaring with laughter.
Yeah, just in the sense of having to, you know, like men often want to go with the fix-it approach or the be-in-control approach. And really with labor, you really just have to surrender, which is a lesson to men too. But really just it's all really about the surrender, about opening up. In fact, with the second pregnancy, Gwen did hypnobirthing, which is really about releasing the fear and releasing and surrendering and doing this breathing exercise. And they say that the folks, the proponents of hypnobirthing say that really what gets in the way of birthing being easy, not easier, but just easy, which is insane, but it's true. And what gets in the way of birthing being easy is just the fear we all have around it. You know, they talk about how all other animals, you know, just sort of like a cat will go into the corner and just sort of moan a little bit, and the baby comes out, I guess. You know, humans make it this crazy thing, and it's our fear of that gets in the way, our sort of acculturated fear. So Gwen did this hypnobirthing, and it really worked. It was amazing.
It made it easier for her, huh?
Yeah, she practiced this very specific breathing exercise that they do, and it was amazing. You know, it's hard to be a man and talk about making labor easy. You know, right now there's like 50 women with pitchforks and torches outside my office.
Yeah, but I think it's really interesting because you guys go in there and usually try to coach and try to help. And I know some guys who find it just hell, sorry to say a nasty word, but it's true. Some men find it really, really difficult to be observing a woman in pain, because even if she's conscious, she might have some pain while she's at it, right?
Absolutely. That was hard. That was really, I mean, I think every guy has that. Now, in my household, I have to say that, and sometimes this happens, I think I play the role of the woman in some ways. In the sense that, like, if something's wrong for me, a lot of times I think my wife does want to brainstorm and make it better, kind of like you'd stereotypically hear from a guy. Whereas I think because of all the yoga, I don't know, I'm very comfortable. Like, I feel like maybe in the process-oriented part of it, you know, I'm saying, oh, I'm sorry, that sounds hard. but it is, it's true.
So you've got your...
My wife is much better than I am in all things parenting, though. And she's especially in... Like, there's so much to do when you're a parent. Like I don't know how she does, like, sorting the kids' clothes in the seasons and as they grow. You know, I've worn the same shirts now. When I was a kid and my dad had a shirt for 20 years, I just thought that was wild and almost, like, criminal. How can you have a shirt for 20 years? But now, you know, that's what it's like. I'm wearing a shirt right now that I bought right now as we speak, I've got this green and gray shirt on, and I bought this shirt probably like 12 years ago, and I consider this one of my newer shirts.
Yes.
But with kids, like every 6 months, you've got to like, you know, totally cull their wardrobe. I don't know how she does it.
Well, because she's a woman, I think that women, would you say, I mean, like when you're a yogi, you're developing your sixth sense in a lot of ways, right? Is she also a yogi? Is she?
She is. Yeah, we met actually at a yoga center years ago.
But I was sort of thinking that whole thing about we women usually do like 15 things at once. You know, you have that natural kind of connecting with whatever's going on in the household, for example, and the clothing and the food and all that stuff, whilst you're reading a book or something else, you know? And
it's interesting. I once read actually that, you know, this is true, but I once read a study years ago that speculated that the reason, or that concluded that the reason women, you know, like oftentimes women, they live longer than men, that's a fact, but they also seem, to me at least, to keep their sanity a little longer than men. I don't know that, you know, like my grandpas, you know, God rest them, they were beautiful men and spiritual souls, but they, you know, they often would say the same thing whenever I would see them into their 80s and 90s, whereas my grandma seemed a little bit more with it and, you know, processing new information over the years. I read a study that said that was because women multitask historically, and this was even true in the old days, really, when women were at home and men were at work. You know, women, it said, through their career of being a housewife and a mother and a person, you know, like multitask, they would do 10 things at once, and they had various chores from housework to raising the kids to cooking to cleaning, and it was just more varied and kept the brain more active, whereas men would go to work and do one thing. I mean, maybe it was putting a gasket on a car on the assembly line, or maybe it was, you know, selling blenders, but they did one thing. And as a result, this study was speculating that's why women kept their kind of alertness into their 80s and 90s more frequently than men.
Well, yeah, because you have to adjust to so many things. I think it must be very frustrating to men who's, from a slightly different perspective, that men like to find solutions, like to fix things, and like to find answers for things. And there's so many, in running a family, there's so many ways that there aren't any real answers. You know what I mean? So women aren't accustomed to getting things fixed all the time. We're just kind of always tilling the soil, watering.
That reminds me, one of the most effective, most powerful, most important tools I found in parenting personally is, it's one of the chapters in the book, is How to Talk So Kids Will Listen and Listen So Kids Will Talk. It's a book written by Adele Faber, and I talk about it in my book. And her approach is exactly what you're talking about, because she's saying that when your child comes to you and says, you know, oh, Billy stole my idea for the class project, I'm so upset. And, you know, she says, rather than, of course, you know, rather than shaming him and saying, oh, well, you shouldn't have given it early, you know, obviously that's not the ideal approach, but even rather than brainstorming how to make it better or how to fix it or giving them a solution, which has all kinds of problems, obviously. Now, if they ask for a solution, that's very different. But
yeah,
let's face it,
usually
kids don't, you know. Mm-hmm. But if they come to you and say, oh, Billy stole my idea, I can't believe it, then there's this whole little model they give, and it's brilliant, it's amazing, and it's like magic. So it's pretty simple. It's basically saying you nod your head and listen and say, and give supportive little grunts like, And then you repeat back to them what you heard. You say, oh, Billy stole your idea. And then you name their feeling. You say, ah, that must be frustrating. And then you can ask as a question what they said. You can say, so he stole your idea? And it's amazing, because when I do this with my kids, they literally come up with their own solutions.
Wow.
And they feel heard, they feel validated, and they feel connected. Because that's what kids really want, is to feel connected to mom and dad. And, you know, when they come and say, oh, you know, Billy stole my truck, you know, and you say, oh, well, you shouldn't leave it out. I mean, that's crappy. You know, nobody wants this. It's a terrible feeling.
But that's probably about as common as can be, isn't it?
Is what?
It's really common.
Oh, totally. Absolutely. It's what we all do. I mean, this model, this formula that they give in the book that I talk about, I love it, and it's so hard for me every day. I mean, I'm able to do it. Some of the formulas I learned in the book from other approaches and things are almost impossible for me to do. But that one I can do, and I love it. One of the most powerful things I learned from it, on a side note, is when I get home from work, I don't know, I just want to grill my kids. I want to know, what did you do? How did you like the lunch I packed? How was school? Did anyone do anything bad? You know, is there any kid I need to go after? I want to make everything good for them. But the book talks about just saying, it's so nice to see you. You know, I love you. It's so nice to see you. And I mean, think about that. Think about you get home from school and your dad grills you, like, because he's trying to, you know, and really when I do that, I'm trying to make myself, I'm trying to soothe my own anxieties, right?
Yeah.
So that's, it's fine. At least I'm, you know, I care. It's better than nothing. But imagine on the other hand, if I come home and the kid comes home and I say, so nice to see you. Oh, you just melt just thinking about it.
Yeah, and then they probably would just tell you what went on anyway at some point in their own relaxed time, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And to go back to the first formula, so like Noah had this thing where he, one time he was making it, my son Noah, he was about, he's eight now. I don't remember how old he was at the time. Let's say he was six. He was making a card for his cousin and he messed it up and he was really upset. He started crying and freaking out, having kind of like a tantrum because the card was messed up. And so, you know, in the past, I would have just brainstormed for solutions. I would have freaked out. I would have run all over the house trying to help him. Or maybe in my worst moment, that's in my helicopter moments, in my worst moments, you know, I might have yelled at him and said, oh, it's nothing, don't worry about it, what are you making a big deal? But in my best moments, I followed this model. And so I said, and I listened to him while he talked. And then I just said, I did what the book said. I said, oh, it's ruined? And just like not patronizing, just like really like a question, like, oh, it's ruined? Like, oh, isn't that terrible? That must be so frustrating. And he, all of a sudden, he just like dropped. He just dropped in. And he felt heard and connected. And that's all that we really want.
And what did he do?
Said, he said, well, no, maybe I can fix it. It's like amazing.
So I
love that.
You needed to get feeling expressed, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I try to use it on Gwen, on my wife. And so she can usually pick up that I'm doing it, though. I don't know. Adults, it doesn't seem to work as well on adults. We do want to be heard. I think adults do want to be heard. But if you, yeah, you know, if your husband comes home or your partner comes home tonight and you say, you know, you say, he took the credit for it. Oh, that must be frustrating. I don't know. I think they might catch on. Maybe not. I don't know.
Well, it's funny because I interviewed John Gray one time. You know, the men are from Mars, women are from Venus thing?
Oh, totally.
And what he says is women need you to just let them talk for about 10 minutes, period. You don't have any solutions, nothing. He said that's what women need. So stop trying to interfere with their expression. They just need to get it out. So that you might be on the right track, but maybe you don't have to be quite as active about it.
Interesting. See, that's the thing. I think I'm a woman, at least in the way I process, because that's what I want for sure.
Really?
I hate it when I like come home with something I'm upset about, and my wife or anybody. It's my wife just because she's the one who's at home, and somebody tells me what to do. Because you know what? Usually we know what to do. We just sort of want to get out the feelings, I think.
You want to express yourself at some level, hey?
Yeah, you want to be heard.
I wonder if this is a totally hypothetical question. I wonder if doing a lot of yoga brings up the more feminine part of our nature, do you think?
Yeah, I do. I think that that's probably it. Especially the kind of yoga that I do. You know, I do the old style of Kripalu yoga, which is sort of a very gentle, mindful, I guess like a feminine yoga, you could almost call it. But like I do, it's a very gentle style and it's a very mindful consciousness yoga, very, you know, that brings you in touch with yourself a lot. As opposed to, let's say, I think a really, really, people might disagree on this. It'd be interesting to see if he gets, you know, maybe we'll get some hate mail. No, I don't know. What's that?
Discussions are good. It's okay.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, but I think that like some of the most yoga these days is very, very physical. It's very, there's probably a word like yin and yang you could use for it or something. You know, a lot, it's very masculine yoga. It's very like jumping around and very physical and strength building. The kind of yoga that I'd say the military could do. There's a lot of that kind of yoga that people really like. And I wouldn't say, I'm not judging that yoga, because I think that all yoga is great, and I think people choose the kind of yoga that fits their constitution and their, you know, who they are and what they need. So it's great. Anybody who does yoga, I think it's wonderful, and I love every style of yoga in that way. But those yogas, they, I'm not sure that they bring a person in touch with their feelings as much, which can be okay. Maybe they do. I'd be curious to hear what people think about that. But so I think you're right. I think many years of yoga would do that.
Yeah, I think that there's this inner gentleness that comes up in you, and I feel like that's so for most people that I know that do yoga. You know, it's not that the feminine is just gentle, but you know what I'm saying? There's kind of a still attention that women can often bring forward, and you're doing a great job on that. I'm going to jump into sort of an odd subject, which we mentioned, circumcision. And I know you come from a Jewish background, right?
Yep.
About circumcision, and what I read in your book is different than what I hear out there. So I thought, would you mind talking about it, please?
No, you know, it's great, actually. So I excerpted some of the circumcision chapter on, I have a Huffington Post column. People can check me out on Huffington Post. Okay. And I excerpted some of the circumcision chapter on the Huffington Post. And I was surprised because my views on circumcision are, I guess they're growing more into the mainstream, but they're a little bit, a lot of the views in the book are kind of alternative. And so I didn't expect the Post to do particularly well, to get that much circulation on the Huffington Post. And it did. It's my most circulated post ever. Thus far, so I was surprised by that, but it got found by the group Intact America, which is the kind of, like, you could call it the lobby group for ending circumcision, really, for keeping baby boys intact, which is the opposite of circumcision, and so they loved the post, and they named me the activist for June. It's called the Intactivist of June.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, I don't think, yeah. I had never heard, you know, and I'm 100 years old now, but I had never heard that people are actually getting reconstructive surgery to replace the foreskin.
Oh, well, that's another story. So, all right, let's start from the beginning.
Okay.
So when Gwen was pregnant, our midwife gave us a book. And I had never really heard of the possibility of not circumcising before. I mean, you know, I grew up in mainstream way in New Jersey and, you know, Jewish, basically. You know.
And I've heard horrible things about the problems of not getting circumcised.
Right, exactly. I mean, when I was a kid, I thought people who weren't circumcised were dirty, you know.
Yeah.
We received lectures about that. And I do even remember a couple girls talking in college, or women, you know, talking in college about how maybe they wouldn't date an uncircumcised man. You know, so I definitely had all those ideas and just seemed like the obvious thing to do. And then, you know, times have changed a little bit and people have opened their eyes and stuff. But so our midwife gave us this book about circumcision. And so I read the book. And I was, as my book says, so first I was very depressed when I read this book, because it really talks about how circumcision first of all, it tells you that circumcision makes the penis smaller. So here we are in the show talking about penis being smaller.
I think half of the people listening probably have one, you know, it's okay.
Have a penis? So, or at least they know somebody who's got one,
right?
Yeah, maybe they might know somebody who has a penis.
Yeah.
So the book talks about how circumcision removes flesh from the penis, and it makes the penis smaller. And, you know, that's not something that you're supposed to tell a man, number one. Number two, talks about how circumcision, and this is the real killer, circumcision makes sex less enjoyable. And so in my book, I go on this whole riff about how it's very hard to test that, because there aren't any double-blind studies where people are volunteering who are not circumcised, volunteering to have sex, rate it 1 to 10, then have circumcision, heal, and then have sex again and rate it. So there aren't too many double-blind studies on the circumcision issue, but it gives pretty compelling evidence that sex would be less pleasurable without a foreskin. Now, I like sex a lot, so I find sex very pleasurable, but apparently maybe it would be even better with a foreskin.
But Brian, how old is circumcision in the Jewish culture? Isn't it really, really old? It's not like since the 1800s or anything, is it?
Well, I don't know fully the history on that. I looked into more circumcision in the non-Jewish culture because in the Jewish culture, it just seemed there was a reason for it beyond health, you know?
Mm-hmm.
There was this traditional reason. And that's, you know, that's enough for many people, and that's okay. But then I thought, well, why are non-Jewish people being circumcised? Why are Christians being circumcised? When did it become popular in the United States? So I looked into that, and the answer is amazing, actually. Apparently, it became popular in the 1800s for various reasons, one of which people were afraid of smegma. So the chapter on circumcision is called The Myth of Smegma. And now smegma is totally natural. It's totally normal. All animal genitalia have smegma. Animal penises have smegma, and it's actually a lubricant. The word smegma is Greek for soap. Smegma is clean, actually.
Oh.
And it actually lubricates the penis and the foreskin for during sexual activity and just in general. It would almost, like, cleaning underneath the foreskin with a Q-tip would be like lifting up your eyelid and rubbing your eyeball with a Q-tip.
Oh, my gosh.
Like, you know, your body works. Your body has mechanisms for keeping itself clean.
That's really interesting because I think a lot of us have heard that's a place of major infection if you're not careful.
Right. I don't know. Maybe 3,000 years ago when people were living in the 100-degree desert and, you know, they couldn't they didn't have access to fresh water for baths or something. Maybe, I don't know, but maybe it was relevant then. But certainly, you know, if you have access to plumbing and, you know, keep clean. I mean, just in the same sense, honestly, that you, if somebody's overweight, you know, very, very overweight, they would need to clean between the flaps of skin in there, you know, and, you know, you need to keep your skin clean or wash behind your ears or something. You know, if there's any area where you're going to get debris trapped, you need to wash yourself or else you'll get irritation or infection. So, I mean, in the same way. But certainly no call for cutting off that skin, I don't think.
That's just really interesting because for me, I go, wow, there's a lot of things that we just don't know and we're just learning about now. It's kind of interesting that way.
Yeah. So that book really opened my eyes and so...
And both your children are boy people.
They are boy people, yeah.
So you didn't have them circumcised, is that right?
That's right, yeah. And in the community I live in, actually, that's totally the norm. I would say there's as many uncircumcised boys as circumcised.
Wow.
You know, when I was a kid, I didn't even know what circumcision was. I didn't realize how my penis looked different than it would have looked if I wasn't circumcised. I just literally didn't know. I didn't know anybody. Who wasn't circumcised, so I just didn't even know what that would be like.
Well, I've just had a few friends, grandmothers, they are very upset because their grandchildren aren't being circumcised lately, and they're terribly upset because they know they're going to be just rife with infection all the time. So.
Yeah, it's not true. You should do a little Googling and then send them the material. Go to Intact America. Go to their Facebook page or website. They've got so much, you know, so many materials, and it's really, really not true. I mean, you know, apparently for the health aspects, and so something I talk about in the book is the American Medical Association and the American Pediatric Association, they've gone back and forth on the circumcision.
Yeah, I was reading
many
that.
Times.
I might get them to read your book. I think that would probably be more helpful, too, because being a grandparent these days is often coming back into more of the extended family consciousness, you know.
You know, the best thing you could do, and this goes for your readers as well, would be to buy a good 30, 40 copies of the book.
Okay.
That's what I would recommend. That's really the best thing you could do for your children is to buy 30, 40 copies of the book and give them out to everybody. No, I'm kidding.
Because it's fun and funny and really practical. You know, I like that a lot.
Yeah.
Now, I didn't get into the section. Do you talk about technology and children in the book?
A little bit. Not that much because my boys... The book ends around when they're like 3 and 6 or so.
I see.
So, you know, as far as TV and technology, we haven't gotten into that too much. But, I mean, a little bit. And again, in the Simplicity Parenting chapter, in the Waldorf chapter, you know, I do think, I mean, technology is around us, but I do think postponing it, and this goes for a lot of things, actually. I remember our midwife told us, postpone solid food really as long as you can. Keep nursing for as long as you can. I mean, within reason.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently, you know, the longer you nurse, the better chance the kids have of avoiding, you know, nut allergies and avocado allergies and egg allergies and all that. And I would say that kind of thinking goes for a lot of things. I would say postpone technology and movies. And, you know, I watched Amityville Horror, Alien, and Poltergeist when I was about 7 years old.
Oh, that
and they
was
still
great.
Haunt me. You know, they still... I'm still haunted. I can't even, my wife makes fun of me because I can't go in the basement by myself at night. I'm too afraid.
But, you know, I've got friends who couldn't stand Bambi. They were terrified. Or The Wizard of Oz or some of the older movies because they were pretty scary, too. I have friends
yeah.
who haven't even seen them because they were freaked out at the movie and left, you know.
Yeah.
So
I think postponing that kind of stuff with kids as long as possible is good. Plus, you know, of course, it allows them to have their own imagination and their own experience of things in their mind and kind of build those imaginative muscles.
And are your kids doing yoga?
They do. They love yoga. They do it with me. Yeah. I talk about in the book, they love meditation too, but they love it a little too much because whenever I'm meditating, they seek me out and they find me and they start meditating with me, which is really great. I mean, you know, it's like a dream come true. My kids want to meditate with me. The problem is that they only meditate for about 3 minutes and then they're done. So then my meditation is done too. But they do. They love it. They think, you know, whatever your dad, when you're seven, whatever your dad and mom do is the greatest thing in the world.
That's true.
We'll see if it's still the greatest when they're teenagers.
Yeah, probably not. And what about...
I may have to pretend to be like a very conservative Republican when they're 10 or 15, and then they'll rebel and become yogis.
And who knows what's going to go on there. Although yoga is pretty old, so I was going to say it might have changed by then, but I guess yoga will always be right in the center of things, eh?
I'd say so, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So what about food? How about getting kids to eat? Do you have a problem with that?
No. I mean, I think that, yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I've read, I think this is Alfie Cohen, a great parenting philosopher and educator. And he talks about how, I think it was him, that talks about, you know, really trusting kids with food. I mean, you know, there are certain things that will obscure our instincts with food, like sugar. Clearly, white sugar will obscure our instincts. I mean, I think, what was it? There was a study with rats once where rats will just eat white sugar until they die or something. You know, white sugar is something that obscures your sense of food. But otherwise, let's face it, we can trust our kids. You know, a lot of people really fret about their kids eating. And long as they're not eating too much sugar, too much fruit juice, I think they'll tell you what they want. I mean, if they want to have a huge, you know, massive feeding of cherry tomatoes for lunch and nothing else, and then at dinner they want to have, you know, meat and nothing else, I think that's probably worth trusting. As a matter of fact, there's that would be called food combining by some natural foodies.
So do you and your wife do that? I mean, put your meat...
We don't do food combining, but we try to trust our kids. I mean, it's hard sometimes. But we try to, you know, like sometimes they, you know, I mean, anybody who has kids knows sometimes your kid will literally seem to eat their weight in food, and then other times they don't want to eat anything for a couple of days almost. And I do think it's worth trusting, especially if they're eating, you know, in a calm environment. If they're eating in an environment where they can be in touch with their selves, they can be in touch with their urges, you know, in other words, not in front of a TV or, you know, not in a wild environment, a chaotic environment, not with the news on about fires and murders. But if they're eating in a, you know, calm environment around a table with family, I would say probably trust the kids. You know, if they want to eat just the tips of asparagus tonight and they eat 2 pounds of asparagus, God bless. And then, you know, tonight they just want to eat only even, I don't know, bread or something. It's probably worth trusting.
But it depends on the nature.
I guess refined flours could be a little tricky because they're almost like sugar.
Yeah. Okay, so now we started late because we had a technological problem here talking about technology. And so we have to end soon, and I really am sorry about that because you're pretty darned full of wonderful information for us all. Can you give a little thumbnail on conscious parenting? Any tips you could give the listeners before you leave?
Yeah, I would say conscious parenting to me. Now, first of all, I started out writing the book, honestly, like anybody probably does, to preach my point of view. But by the end of the book, I realized that it wasn't about that. It wasn't about whether you do cloth diapers or not, or whether you do, you know, baby wearing, you know, slings, or whether you co-sleep or have a crib. I think it's not really about that, honestly. It's really about... because if it was, we would all do the same thing. I mean, there can't be one right answer or else we'd all be doing it. Just like there can't be one right religion or else we'd all be that religion, right? I mean, how could one religion be right? So I think conscious parenting is not whether you co-sleep or, you know, I mean, I have my certain beliefs on those things, but it's not that. I think conscious parenting is what we've been talking about the whole time. Conscious parenting is about checking in with our heart, getting in touch with our heart, checking in with our intuition and our instincts, and parenting from that place, making choices from that place of connecting to our own heart, connecting to the hearts of our kids, slowing down, just all the things we've been talking about doing for kids, doing for ourselves, you know, slowing down, maybe less media, maybe listening to our bellies when it comes to food more, and parenting from that place. I think that would be conscious parenting.
And I think it's interesting where you're writing about not realizing how stressed and how unable to focus parents can be when you've got two young kids and you're trying to cover all bases until later, and then you look back and go, oh my goodness, and you see other people that are completely stressed and not making much sense. I think it helps to be conscious of that, doesn't it?
Oh gosh, I remember two things. I remember one, when I was younger, there's this guy who would always be walking around town, and he was a dad, and he had a little baby. But I was pre-having kids. I don't even think I was married yet. And I just had no idea what that would be like. So I remember I always judged him. I hate to say it, but I did. I thought, why is this guy rushing around all the time? You know, his head in front of his body, moving fast, rushing. You know, why can't he just slow down? I really did. And, you know, now that I have kids, I want to seek him out to apologize to him because I get it. I was going to say one more thing. In the book, I joke too, you know, I'm being facetious because I understand sometimes divorce is obviously necessary, but in the book I sort of facetiously joke that it's almost like divorce should be illegal for people with little kids, not on any kind of moral ground, but just because parents turn into monsters when they have little kids, especially if they're not sleeping. And it's just like they're not in a sound mind to make, you know, it's like a contract. You have to be in sound mind. You're not in a sound mind to make such a big decision because, you know, just parents can be monsters to each other when the kids are really little. And I think it gets better. You know, it really gets better. And the mom or the, you know, the dad or the husband, the wife that you loved 3 years ago will return. One day the Hulk will turn back into Bruce Banner.
And it's interesting because you got two people and your instincts about parenting are going to be based on certain personal experiences and prejudice, as well as being very conscious a lot of the time. So there's a lot of disagreement potential in there, isn't there?
Absolutely. It's true. Yeah.
Well, I've really enjoyed talking to you, Brian, and I love this book. I will give the title again, Misadventures of a Parenting Yoga by Brian Leaf. And it's easily accessible, right, on Amazon?
Yep. Anybody can get it. Actually, it should be available from any bookstore, hopefully. You should be able to find it in your local bookstore, and you can get it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, anywhere books are sold.
And I love the cross-referencing in it. Also, and you do your, what's the final thing, Huffington Post, you do a regular column?
Yep, yeah, I write for Huffington Post. People can find all my stuff if they go to my website, which is misadventuresofayogi.com. You can check me out on Facebook at Misadventures of a Yogi. Misadventures of a Garden State Yogi, I think, is the Facebook page. And on Huffington Post, just look up Brian Leaf. Leaf like leaf on a tree.
And is it always a misadventure?
Well, so far, we'll see what the next book might just be Misadventures of a Gluten-Free Yogi, but we'll have to see.
Oh, that sounds like fun. All right, well, you are making it fun for a lot of us to get conscious and explore real living, so thank you so much, Brian.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on the show.
Take care.
You too.
All right.